On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Centers for Disease Control now estimates that one in every 166 American children is born with autism. That adds up to a lot of kids, grandkids, neighbors, schoolmates. What was once considered rare can now look like an epidemic, cause still unknown. Autism and autistic children can challenge even the most loving families and caring schools. Now a big new generation of autistic kids is moving into adulthood and huge uncertainties about how they will live. And in Washington, the fur is flying over how the country will fund research and care. And the family touched directly may be your own. Up next on Point, from Capitol Hill to every neighborhood, confronting the tide of autism. Joining me first today from New York is Julie Scalfo, assistant editor at Newsweek magazine and co-author of last week's cover story, What Happens When They Grow Up. Julie, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you found a great big population of autistic kids moving toward adulthood, with the implication being what?
You know, it's so incredible. I think autism has long been associated in most people's minds with young children. But now that doctors are so much better at diagnosing it than they were 20 years ago, 40 years ago, what we have is a whole generation of kids who are growing up. They're teenagers, they're becoming adults, and they're facing all sorts of new problems. Their parents are facing new problems because many of these children are going to need lifelong care, and their parents have to figure out what exactly their lives are going to look like.
Grappling with autism in children has offered its own challenges in loving and caring and coming to terms and coming to understanding. What are the challenges that emerge as this big generation of autistic kids moves into, you know, 18, 20, 21, beyond? What happens?
I mean, when they're small, what the parents usually focus on is giving them behavioral interventions, emotional interventions to teach them how to speak. Again, there's such a huge range in the autism spectrum. So some kids have severe language impairment. They can't speak at all. Other kids are highly functional, highly skilled, exceptional, intellectual capability. But they have emotional problems. So parents, when they're young, focus on kind of helping them be as normal as possible, getting them into a regular school program if possible. But by the time that they're teenagers or young adults, parents are wondering, how are they going to ever live on their own? Will they be able to live on their own? What will they do each day? Will they have a job? What kind of job will it be?
That is, as their parents age, perhaps at some point parents die. What are the options for adult autistic citizens in this country?
I mean, that's what's so scary. There are almost no options. The idea of a group home is still, one consideration, but there are very few group homes that specialize in people with people with autism and their specific needs. So there's a group home option. There's keeping your kids at home, living at home. But again, many of these people can't drive, so their parents, even if they can find some kind of work for them, their parents would have to drive them every day of their lives. Feeding themselves, are they able to do that? Do they need some kind of medication? Are they capable of administering their own medication? So there's just a huge range of issues that parents have to consider for their kids as they become adults.
Julie, there's one point on which you've been challenged publicly. That is Newsweek, since this big cover story came out, saying critics have said you're buying into the idea that there's just more diagnosis here. Others see an epidemic, a genuine surge, not just we're recognizing this more widely, but the incidence is actually dramatically increasing. Where do you come down on that?
Well, Tom, I encourage your listeners to pick up a copy of Newsweek or go online to Newsweek.com and read the story, because it's a very kind of controversial issue, and we spent a lot of time and did a ton of research to figure out the answer.
But you say two decades into the surge in diagnosis. Does that mean you're saying there's not an epidemic, there's just more diagnosis?
There's definitely more diagnosis, and there are definitely more cases, so both things are true. There is an astounding number of people with autism. Unfortunately, within the sort of internet community, sometimes people pick up the highest number. They say there's one in 166 cases.
That's from the Centers on Disease Control, I believe.
Well, the Centers for Disease Control says it's between 1 in 500 and mm-hmm. 1 in 166. Mm-hmm. So that's the number we use in our story. Mm. So there's a range. It's hard to know exactly, again, because of the range in diagnoses. There's, you know, a severe case in which a child can't speak, can't really function, might have physical difficulties, compared to a high-functioning Asperger's person who, you know, might now be the CEO of a company. So it's hard to know exactly who's all included, and various various regions of the country have conducted population studies to try and count the number of people with autism, but there has been no national count, so there is no exact number. But as best as the CDC can tell, there's about 500,000 children under 21 living with autism today.
And Julie, bring us up to date in a nutshell on this Combating Autism Act on Capitol Hill. There's been a big fight around it. Texas Republican Joe Barton right in the middle of that. What does this nearly billion dollar legislation proposed to do, and where does it stand on Capitol Hill?
The legislation proposes to direct more money towards autism research, both in terms of figuring out what exactly it is, because scientists are still trying to understand how it works in the brain, and working towards some possibility of a cure. But they can't even do that, of course, until they fully understand it. It also designates money for each state to set up programs, hotlines, centers to help parents get early diagnosis and early intervention, because that is the only thing that we know for certain helps relieve the symptoms of autism. This bill passed in the Senate earlier this year. It's been held up in Congress by Senator Barton, but Senator Barton's staff told us last week that they had arrived at a compromise, and hopefully they'll be introducing it for a vote soon.
So there may be action in Washington. Judy Scalfo at Newsweek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Judy Scalfo, assistant editor at Newsweek magazine. She spoke with us from New York. Joining me now from New York is Allison Singer. She is senior vice president at Autism Speaks and one of the drivers behind legislation before Congress to fund new research on autism. Her 9-year-old daughter, Jody, is autistic. She also has a 7-year-old daughter, Lauren, who does not have the disorder. She just applied to be the guardian of her older brother, Stephen, who is also autistic and living in a group home. Allison Singer, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
You've been a big advocate of the autistic on Capitol Hill recently. Describe for us how you came through your personal experience to get enmeshed with this issue and these lives.
Well, as you said, my daughter, Jody, was diagnosed with autism when she was 2 years and 8 months old. And at that time, I was basically told goodbye and good luck. If you have a child that's diagnosed with cancer or another terrible disease, there's an articulated standard of care. A doctor can tell you, go see this specialist, go to this hospital. But unfortunately, that's not the case with regard to autism. It's up to parents to navigate the winding maze of services and potential treatments. And the services that are available very much depend on the state and the community in which you live. And one of the things that we wanted to try to do with the Combating Autism Act was to make sure that there were early diagnosis and early treatment options available in all 50 states. The reason that's so important is because, as Julie said, early intervention is the best weapon that we have against autism. Studies show that 50% of children who are diagnosed with autism, who are in a good early intervention program before they're 3 and remain in that program for 2 years, 50% of those children gain enough skills to be able to be mainstreamed for kindergarten.
Mm. Allison, there's a lot of talk about the range, as Julie was saying, the range of people are saying we shouldn't say autism, we should say autisms. Give us a sense of that range, and where does your daughter Jody fall in it?
Well, autism is now called autism spectrum disorder in recognition of the wide range of functioning of different people with autism, ranging from lower functioning to much higher functioning. My daughter, unfortunately, is lower functioning. She has, through very intensive early intervention, been able to gain some functional language. She's in a school now specifically for children with autism. The school has 14 children in it, and a very talented and dedicated staff that's very well trained in working with children with autism. But that's not an option that a lot of people have. A lot of families are forced to scrape together the best possible educational and treatment program for their kids that they can. And it is a struggle every day, not only to work with your child as a mom or as a dad, but also to try to work with your school district and the teachers mm-hmm. to make sure that your child is maximizing his or her potential.
There's been a lot of heat in Washington about this Combating Autism Act, particularly directed at Texas Republican Joe Barton, chair of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. Don Imus's wife, the radio show host, has been involved in addressing autism. He's gone after the representative on the air, called him a lying fat little skunk from Texas. What's the emotion around this issue on Capitol Hill? What's the holdup? What's the problem?
Well, there's tremendous emotion in general among families who have children with autism. There's a tremendous lack of services, lack of support, lack of resources, lack of even a standard of care for individuals with autism. And I think a lot of the frustration has been played out with regard to the Combating Autism Act. Families are demanding answers. We're demanding action. It's time that the federal government recognize that autism is an epidemic. 10 years ago, 1 in 10,000 children were diagnosed. Now 1 in 166 children are diagnosed. We need the Congress to declare war on autism. We need more funding for research. We need more funding for early diagnosis and treatment. We need more funding for awareness so that new parents will know the early warning signs of autism so that they can recognize those signs in their child and get those children into early intervention as quickly as possible. I think all new parents know the physical milestones that children should reach. Parents also need to know the developmental milestones that that children should reach so that if there's an issue, they can talk to their doctor and they can take action early.
We've been joined from New York by Allison Singer. Her daughter Jody is autistic. She's senior vice president of Autism Speaks, been pushing hard for new legislation, more money for research and care coming out of Washington. We're joined right now as well from Nashville, Tennessee, by Pat Levitt. He's director at the Kennedy Center for Research on Human Development at Vanderbilt University, professor of pharmacology there, published a paper last month that found a genetic mutation that raises the risk of autism. Pat Levitt, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
What's the latest that we know about why this is happening? What's the source, as far as we know, of autism?
I think it's a combination of our ability in the healthcare area and for families to recognize when there are issues in a child's development. So we have better recognition. There are clearly more cases. And I think the truth of the matter is we think it may be a combination both of better diagnosis, but also, you know, your gut tells you something, that there's something that's been introduced, experiences that that are out there in the environment that have changed over the last 30-plus years that said there's something else going on.
So you know people have looked all over. People have been very concerned about the mercury that was once in vaccines, lots of concern about the heavy metals in the environment, and a huge list of things. You've done a lot of research on this. Where does your research point now, and how does it support or refute these suspected sources of autism?
Well, you know, my own research is focused on the genetic aspects because we know that out of all common brain-based disorders, autism carries the heaviest genetic load. If you look at identical twins, if one twin has autism, there's about a 60 to 90% chance that the other identical twin will have autism. So that's a very heavy genetic load. Is there something else environmental or some other experience? Likely, because we know that experience or things that either a fetus or a young infant gets exposed to can change the course of development. But the bottom line in terms of the research that's been done thus far is that we haven't identified anything in the environment. The mercury studies that have been done are either they're inconclusive or people just don't believe the epidemiology. But there really isn't any study thus far that says this is it, this is the one thing. And frankly, because we know it is the autisms or autism spectrum disorder, like the number of genes, 5 to 20 in different combinations, there could be a number of different environmental factors that act as the trigger in this case.
What physically happens in a child with autism? What's going on there that does not go on in a normal child?
Well, we know that there is a change in brain architecture, and the blueprint for how the brain gets wired together occurs before birth, but there's a lot of development in terms of changing that architecture over time during infancy and into toddlerhood and even into adolescence, particularly in parts of the brain that are involved in more complex kinds of functions. It appears that the trajectory of development for children with autism is different because their brain sizes typically are a little bit larger. And the few studies that have been done thus far appear to show that they start out larger, but over time they kind of don't show a positive trajectory. They're kind of flat. So by the time you look at head size or brain size in a preteen, they're actually a little bit on the smaller side. So that tells us, not specifically what's going on within the brain, but it says something about the journey that the brain is taking during the typical course of development is not happening in the same way as it does in a typical individual.
And the main symptoms or range of symptoms that doctors, that parents can, should look for over time?
Well, you know, you've already heard this. There are, because it is a spectrum, people kind of focus on differences initially in the diagnosis about social behavior, the ability or even the willingness to engage in social behavior, verbal communication, the use of words, as well as nonverbal communication, the use of gestures, and then repetitive behavior or restricted interest. Those actually change over time as well. And from child to child, the trajectory of those, some components of those can get worse, some can get better. And that's really what is, you know, been so difficult for scientists because it's a moving target in some ways. We know that in a typical child that goes, for example, from pre-adolescence to adolescence, there are a lot of changes in brain chemistry and brain architecture. That's no different in a child with autism as well. We just don't know what it means to go through those changes when you start out on an atypical developmental path.
Pat Levitt in Nashville, Allison Singer in New York, please stand by. We have a lot of listeners with experiences and questions. Let me turn to Martin in Fairfax, South Carolina. Hi, Martin. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm the son of a boy that's going to turn 10 on Saturday. And
the father of, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
And he is... He has the higher function Asperger's.
Uh-huh.
The most difficult road that my wife and I had to walk was getting to the diagnosis. He had, you know, I'm listening to your experts, and, you know, they're putting out the symptoms, and they were all there. I mean, my son had the larger size head, you know, when he was a boy, you know, little, going to the pediatrician, the delayed speech. I mean, he didn't speak until he was... almost 3.5 years old. Now you can't shut him up, frankly. But
but how old was he before you figured out what was going on here, Martin?
He was in preschool, and we finally did get a diagnosis. We got hooked up with a pediatrician who completely understood what he required. When he got into primary school, we had a principal that read up on it and you know, knew what it was he was going to require. The special education coordinator for our school district also already was smart, but, you know,
It sounds like they got on team with you. Did it work?
That is the whole point. My son now is mainstreamed.
That's great.
I mean, he does require the assistance of a medication, which a prominent Hollywood actor recently criticized another Hollywood actress for giving to her child. But
Tom Cruise, et cetera, yeah.
Yeah, et cetera. We can leave that one out. That's another show, another day. But the getting to the diagnosis and getting the team, the parent, the school folks, the pediatrician, you know, you get all of those folks on. Now, granted, you know, I'm blessed by the fact that my son is higher function, but that was key. But
Martin, let me ask you, how do you and your wife now think about your son's adulthood? Do you believe he'll be able to work, to live independently, or not?
Well, I tell you, it may sound like a flippant remark, but my son so much is a carbon copy of the character Monk on television. I mean, I can see my son being a detective because he notices everything. Like Saturday or Friday, we went out shopping, and I dropped my car key into the basket at the grocery store.
Right.
We go out to the car. I'm looking for my key everywhere. And then my son pipes up, Daddy dropped it into the, you know, my son notices this.
So he's on top of it, like
yeah,
Monk,
I mean,
played by Tony Shalhoub there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so, I mean, they're, you know, and my wife looked at me and she says, now see, aren't you glad he has Asperger's?
He knows what's going on, but still, I'm sure you've got your concerns about his future as well. Martin, thank you for that story. Alison Singer, what about it on two fronts? First, I mean, here's Martin with his son who's very high functioning, but you hear the curve of time that he and his wife went through to figure that out. What is the experience of most people in getting a diagnosis? And then what about looking ahead? What portion of kids with autism can look forward to living on their own, working on their own?
Well, I think Martin raised a very important point, and that is we need to do a better job of educating medical practitioners and clinicians to recognize the warning signs. We have a public service awareness campaign that Autism Speaks is producing in conjunction with the Ad Council that targets families, empowering them to learn the signs and to talk to their doctor. But we also have to make sure that we are educating doctors and nurse practitioners and daycare providers and preschool teachers to learn the early warning signs of autism so that if parents raise an issue or ask a question with regard to a red flag, the medical community can respond appropriately. Doctors need to know, need to recognize the warning signs and refer to a developmental pediatrician or a pediatric neurologist for a complete evaluation if there's any question at all that a child is not meeting all of the developmental milestones.
I want to bring another perspective in, if I may. Joining us from Washington, a friend of On Point, we've talked with him many times about world affairs, where he's got great insight. Now he and his family also have been dealing with autism right there in their nuclear family. Michael O'Hanlon joins us. He's senior fellow in foreign policy studies at Brookings Institution. He wrote an op-ed with his wife, Catherine Garland, in last Tuesday's New York Times titled, Studying Autism Isn't Enough. He has two daughters. The older, who is 4 years old, has autism. Michael O'Hanlon, thanks very much for being with us.
Very nice to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Let's go straight to the big picture first. Do you think this country has an epidemic of autism going on, and are we adequately at grips with it if we do?
Well, I think others are much better placed to answer that. I don't pretend to know a lot about the question of how much greater the incidence is today, but I am confident in saying one thing, the incidence is very high. So just how fast it's growing is a matter that others who know the science much better should weigh in on. But it's just remarkable, especially when you start getting into the activism world and you write an op-ed or do something even relatively small and limited like my wife and I did last week. You hear from all sorts of friends who either have somebody in their family or occasionally a child themselves. And I just feel that, you know, the numbers of 1 in 150, 1 in 200 that we often hear bandied about are clearly correct. There are just a lot of people dealing with this broad spectrum of issues. As your caller from South Carolina, I believe, mentioned a moment ago, there's a wide range of capabilities and probably a wide range of underlying problems. They have some common presentation, some common symptoms, but across that spectrum, there are just a huge number of people in this country afflicted.
So now your four-year-old daughter is wrestling with, the whole family, of course, that means, is wrestling with it. You are right there in Washington watching the policy issues unfold. What do you think the country needs from, in this case, the federal government when it comes to autism?
Well, we're starting to do some work, and Allison's organization and some others are helping us, and there's some people involved from Cure Autism Now and Autism Speaks and other places.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that, you know, we have to keep an open mind at this point about whether we should mandate that insurance companies cover the kinds of therapies, especially in those preschool years when educational systems usually aren't up to snuff on handling these sorts of things.
And you point out that if you're not well off, that can be absolutely unaffordable to get the kind of treatment you'd like to have.
Right, and it's hard enough, of course, again, as your conversation has pointed out, it's hard enough to figure out what the problem is, to figure out who to go to see, to figure out how you as parents can help reinforce whatever the professionals are doing, and then on top of that, to have your entire family finances be destroyed is really too much. And what it means is that most parents and most children on the spectrum don't get the kind of therapy that they should in these crucial years. Obviously, we have a whole lifetime of challenges with folks afflicted by autism, but those preschool years are so critical for trying to get people to get to a point where perhaps they don't recover, but they do have much greater opportunity for the rest of their lives. And in those crucial years, we need to help people afford this treatment because 90% of them can't.
Michael O'Hanlon, we wish your family good luck there, and we're grateful to you for speaking up, raising the profile of autism and the whole issue. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Let me go to Stuart in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Stuart. You're on the air.
Hi,
Tom. Hi.
We have a son who's just about 9 and is a fairly high-functioning Asperger's kid.
Yeah.
Wondering what the future looks like for someone who is a whiz at a number of things and then will walk out the door every once in a while without a shoe on. Just is very high-functioning, but then at times sort of getting the focus on what is needed to be, what is necessary to do here and now.
Mm-hmm.
What does the future look like for that sort of kid?
That sort of kid. So here you are at the high end, very high end functioning, just Asperger's, and that issue of adulthood and the future clearly on your mind. Allison, what do you say to Stuart?
I think that's a huge challenge, and again, it comes down to the fact that we don't really have an articulable standard of care. I think
will this one of the young issues, man need care?
Well, I think one of the issues we've seen with children with Asperger's who are very intelligent and therefore pushed into the mainstream or able to be in the mainstream is that they're often expected to navigate the social world in ways that are very challenging for them. And I think what we really have to focus on with regard to children and teenagers with Asperger's is to develop some treatments and therapies that really hone in on deficits with regard to social skills. And we're starting to see the emergence of more social skills groups that are grouped by age and are including non-disabled peers who serve as mentors. And we see those in some of the public schools, but very few. And we really need to study those, figure out what works, understand the best practices, and then replicate them in public schools across the country so that all children and teenagers who need social skills intervention are able to get to that.
Pat Levitt, Stuart's got a son with Asperger's, high-functioning autism, and just this, the question is simple. Of course, you don't see the boy in front of you, but what can he look forward to in the future?
Well, you know, I think he raises an issue that we deal with in the developmental disability community all the time. You know, there are two issues. One is we know that early intervention in all ranges of developmental disabilities is true with Down syndrome, by the way, where there's 1 in 700 live births. It's true in autism. Early intervention is more cost-effective over the lifetime because it changes the developmental trajectory, changes brain architecture in a positive way. That's why it works. It's not that you can't do things later, but it's a lot more expensive. And the other thing that I tell parents, and I do a lot of speaking to parents and to education groups and to policymakers, is that you know, little people with issues and problems grow up if there's no intervention to become adults with problems and issues, and sometimes they can even be more complicated. And we're facing a crisis, not just in autism, but in all areas of developmental disabilities.
We're joined from Nashville by Pat Levitt at Vanderbilt University, from New York by Allison Singer. She's Senior Vice President at Autism Speaks. And right now from Ridgeland, South Carolina, by Claudia. Hi, Claudia. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a early retiree from education, special education, and I've taught many beautiful children who were autistic. And like I told the lady that picked up on me, some of the most frustrating and the most rewarding students I've ever had, because when we had successes, they were monumental, but finding the right key to get to that success was sometimes very frustrating.
And how did you define success with the children you worked with, Claudia?
Individually, depending on where they were when I got them and what our specific goals were for each individual child.
What are your thoughts about autism and adulthood when you projected forward from the kids you were working with and thought about them in the world or 21 plus? What's the picture?
Some of my children would need to be, well, are now, mm-hmm. in a group-type home. I have two. One in a group-type home, one who will probably end up in a group-type home if the family can't continue to care for him. I had three others that will probably end up working independently because they were very high functioning.
And Claudia, just share with us, if you would, the impact on the other children in the school where the autistic children you were working with was. How would you describe it? You say frustrating and rewarding for you. What about for their peers, the children around them?
Well, small town. Two different small towns I worked in with them. And for the most part, the children were very accepting of the individuals. To some degree, they were sort of, you know, different, and anything that's different, children can be cruel. But for the most part, people accepted them as who they were and what they could do.
Claudia, thanks very much for sharing your experience. Let's go to Hazel Green, Wisconsin, if I may, and Suzanne. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, I have a 14-year-old grandson who is very deeply autistic,
mm-hmm.
At the lower end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
He was diagnosed by a doctor when he was just past 2 years old. Therefore, no advice as to what to do, and we stumbled across a program called the LOVAS method, and my daughter and her other children moved to that town, and he was in intensive therapy for 3 years, which helped somewhat, but not a whole lot.
Now he's 14. The whole family must be thinking about the adult years ahead. What are your plans?
Absolutely. Well, right now they are working with a group for some advice and direction as to what to do. And a big step for him is just tying his own shoes, that type of just basic living skill.
So will he need to be in a group home later? Is that the plan or something else?
I believe he probably will because he has very erratic sleep patterns which go along with this syndrome, and there are times that he's awake like for 48 hours.
Suzanne, this is your grandson. Do you sometimes lay awake at night wondering if we've got an epidemic in this country?
I believe we do have an epidemic. I don't know if it's just that they're being labeled right now, mm-hmm. as to 10, 15 years ago, not. But I do believe we have an epidemic. And, yes, I lay awake and pray for him every day.
Our best wishes to your family right there, Suzanne, and thank you for your call. Alison Singer, this issue of adulthood and sibling relationships comes up. I mean, parents age, siblings are there, they know their brother or sister well. Are we going to see siblings stepping up and becoming lifelong caretakers for autistic brothers and sisters?
I think we may have to. I mean, I think about this all the time. I have another daughter. Her name is Lauren. Mm-hmm. She's 7. And I try to remind myself that she has never known a life without autism. Mm-hmm. She thinks it's perfectly normal to live in a household where therapists are parading in and out. Most of my time is spent focused on working with Jody, mm-hmm. Helping her to advance her skills or just calming her. She has terrible tantrums. Like your Suzanne, your caller, mm-hmm. said, my daughter is up all night. So Lauren is often up all night.
But
is it too much to ask the entire family?
Is it too much to ask that Lauren, her sister, might think of giving a lifetime's care, or is that just what comes with being part of a family where there's autism?
I hope that will be Lauren's choice, but it will have to be Lauren's choice. I think that it would be unfair for me to thrust that upon her if that was not something that she chose to do. Now, she loves her sister, and she is probably the most vocal advocate for her sister of anyone I know. She is one of the best teachers of her sister. She pulls Jody to play with her, to play with her friends, pulls her outside, gets her involved, is able to get Jody to gain skills, talk more, play games in a way that none of her therapists or other adults can do. So it's wonderful to see the relationship growing between the two of them. Lauren is really the only other child with whom Jody has a relationship. Mm-hmm. But to ask her or to assume that she will take on that responsibility when she's an adult, again, I hope it's something that she will choose, but I don't think it's something that my husband and I would expect of her.
Big decisions, you know, Tom, looming out there. Yes, Pat.
Yeah, I think Allison brings up a really important point that, there aren't going to be, you sort of mentioned group homes a number of times. There aren't going to be enough group homes in this country to be able to deal with all the individuals who are going to grow up with autism. We already know, we already have this situation now with adults, young and older individuals and siblings. It's interesting. Here at the Kennedy Center, we have something called Sib Shops that meets, and it's only the brothers and sisters of an individual with a disability who come, and they talk about their life. They talk about their bond with their brother or sister who has autism or another disability. There's something really special about that link, and there's also something very special about the insight, believe it or not, that an 8 or 9 or 10-year-old typical brother or sister has about what they can look forward to. And
well, speak to us about that. I mean, I'm sure they have great insight, but do you feel them, even at that age, bracing for a lifetime relationship, care of an autistic sibling?
I think they talk about it in the Sib Shops. There's when they talk about the things that they think about a lot, that they worry about a lot, who's going to take care of them? I'm going to be part of the team. They think of it sometimes as a team with mom and dad and with the extended family. Mm-hmm. But they also recognize as they get a little older that the primary responsibility may end up falling on their shoulders, particularly when they get into the teenage years and they realize that the resources just really aren't there to handle all that we're going to have to handle in terms of adults with autism.
When you think about what it takes already and what it's going to take to manage this, the mind goes right back to that incidence and how high it is. And you can feel in the country, Pat Levitt, a sense that somehow we're not, right or wrong, this may be wrong, but a sense that we're not getting the full story on autism, that there may be causes that are not being labeled because, I don't know, they're tied to industry or tied to lifestyle, tied to economics and power. I mean, you're in the heart of research on this. Is that unencumbered research? Are we addressing this fully and frankly?
It's unencumbered research. I can talk to you just about my experience and a lot of colleagues and you know, Alice can talk about this in terms of what Autism Speaks doing. I can talk about it in terms of what Cure Autism Now is doing because I'm the chair of their scientific advisory board. I see applications coming in. We're looking for, as a field, research in all of these areas, including environmental issues, combination of genes and environment. But the problem is that the brain, the brain's complicated. And we're trying to understand the development of functions like social behavior and interaction and communication, which are so highly developed in humans. And we don't know, to be honest, a lot about how they develop typically anyway. We know a lot about how our senses develop, but these other things are so complicated. So I think people, part of the reason I go out and talk to non-science groups, two things. One is to get people in the healthcare industry. Allison hit on this again. I think it's really important. We're graduating our medical students and nurses and other healthcare professionals who may in their three to four years see no children or one child with autism because it's not part of their curriculum. That's a fundamental change we have to make now without even figuring out what causes autism. But the other is to get people to understand that the problem from a neuroscience perspective is complicated. And it's not that we're trying to hold things back, but we do need a lot more research. And there are laboratories now, like my own. I didn't start out studying autism, that are spending half of their time trying to understand what's going on.
Allison, of course, it's complicated, but the numbers are alarming. You focused on this a lot. Do you see, suspect, feel resistance to greater research here because what we learn may be in conflict with big economic interests or with industrial interests or the way we live? Do you fear that?
What I fear is that we won't raise enough money to fund all of the research that we have to fund. I think we still need to cast a very wide net when it comes to autism research, because we don't have enough answers yet to say it's this or it's that. We need to have a better understanding, first of all, of the mechanism of action of autism. We don't even, as Dr. Levitt said, understand exactly what the mechanism of action is. And that's critical if we want to be able to develop evidence-based treatments and start to understand how drugs may work to help individuals who are afflicted with autism. So this year, Autism Speaks will fund approximately $15 million worth of research, and Cure Autism Now will fund an equal amount, but that's not near where we need to be. We estimate that we need to be funding at the level of $100 million a year. That's what other diseases, other large disease groups are funding, and that's really what it takes to get to a cure in the next 10 years. And that is our goal. We want to fund research, we want to understand treatments, and we want to find a cure.
A cure. Sharda's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Sharda. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
Parents of younger children have been calling, and I thought my son is 21.
Yes.
He will turn 22 next year.
Is he autistic, Sharda?
He is autistic, and he is on the lower spectrum. Mm-hmm. When he was diagnosed in 1990, even then, there was nothing. Now, 18 years later, there is nothing. They keep finding money for research. Research is good, but let's help us today. Get the kids into early intervention today. He missed the early intervention. He was diagnosed almost 4. My daughter was 9 years old.
Yeah.
I was hoping they will come up with something, diagnosis, something genetically, are there chances that she will have a child with autism?
Sharda, have you felt supported or lonely in dealing with your son's autism?
Not lonely, but I had to fight every day for the last 19 years.
We hear that, and we hear the emotion, and we're with you, Sharda. We appreciate your call. Pat Levitt, Sharda's worried about the genetic link here. Allison's brother was autistic, now so is her daughter. What do we know about how this passes by generation? Does it pass within families? Is the incidence higher, greater? Does she need to be worried about her daughter's children?
Yeah, there's a greater risk for relatives. There's a greater risk for brothers. One child has autism in the family, there's a higher risk for brothers and sisters within that family and for the next generation. That's why we're studying the younger brothers and sisters of those who already have autism, the baby sibling consortium that's been put together to look at clues that may emerge early on so that we better recognize what's going on. The work that we did and was published last month on this gene called MET increases the risk about somewhere between 2 and 2.5 times if you carry this change in the gene. And there are going to be other genes that are going to come down relatively shortly. My prediction is within the next year or so, there'll be several other genes that will, in combination, raise the risk. That'll help, but I think your last caller, you know, points out an important feature. You know, sometimes we have answers right at our fingertips in terms of building programs now that will really be supportive. We don't have to actually know right now what the causes are. We want to know what the causes are and to be able to prevent this for future generations. But, you know, we, for example, in Tennessee, give occupational therapy full support for somebody who has cerebral palsy. But, you know, Wendy Stone, who runs our autism program here, and I had to go before the Tennessee State Legislature to convince them that autism was a brain-based disorder and that if we're going to cover care for individuals with other brain-based disorders, children, then we can't, as a society, be serendipitous about which ones we want to cover and which ones we don't want to cover.
And Allison,
so there's a lot that we can do.
Allison hopes for a cure within 10 years. You're in the midst of the research and treatment. Does that seem at all possible?
Well, let me see. Allison posed that. I think it's possible that we'll understand a lot about the causes and therefore we'll be much better off 10 years from now in terms of just simply being able to prevent this. That's my prediction. You know, cure, I don't know. You know, I grew up with a speech impediment myself. I have a developmental disability, and I had a very severe speech impediment when I was a child. So people look at me and they say, well, you're cured. Well, no, there are certain times where I'm not cured, and I have certain idiosyncratic behaviors that kind of develop because I have a developmental disability that will always be with me. But do I function well? The answer is yes, and I think that will happen within the next 10 years. But $100 million, to be honest, Allison's right, but it seems like a drop in the bucket when we're considering what we're going to face.
Our prayers and our hopes and all our support go to these kids and their families and to the young adults that we're talking about right here. Pat Leavitt at Vanderbilt University, thanks very much for joining us today for this conversation.
Thanks, Tom.
And Allison Singer, Senior Vice President at Autism Speaks, good luck to your daughter Jody, your daughter Lauren, your brother Stephen, and to you. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.